Okay, so last time we were trying to sort of set the scene for why we're looking at network protocols and, you know, again, why the tools that we're going to use are of interest. And so the basic idea is that you have these complex networks and they're purpose is to deliver data between distributed applications, so possibly around the world, and the networks themselves offer services to do that. Okay, and the services say something about how they'll deliver the data is delivered. A lot of times, not a whole pile about how the data is delivered. Maybe, but do you guarantee that it gets there or not? And will it arrive in order or not? Okay. Matched against that, you have applications. So you have the people sending the data, and they have their wishes and desires in terms of how that data is sent. And those typically have to do with how much data do I have to send, so what's the sort of bandwidth or the transmission speed at which I have to send the data. Can I tolerate delays or not? Can I tolerate loss or not? And again, the problem is that network services don't say anything about delays and loss, okay? So what we can do is we can ask, well, if we set up networks in certain ways, what are the characteristics of delays and loss going to be? Again, that's very complicated. It's complicated because the networks are complex. It's complicated because the usage of the networks is complex. It has a statistical flavor to it. So everything we're going to study about how you study the thing, you know, after this first introductory period is about the statistical nature of networks. Okay. And so what we said was for data networks specifically, is sort of separate from telephony networks, the prevailing architecture is the layered network architecture, the think TCP/IP. And what that layered structure allows you to do is to isolate specific protocols and look at the sort of impact of specific protocols on the problem, or possibly, you know, again, just have to, you know, look at the thing in aggregate. Okay, so what we said was, okay, so we have this physical layer and this layered network architecture. And again, just because not everybody coming into this program has done networks before, we're going to spend a little time just reviewing the protocols associated with the various layers, and again, seeing how they feed into this quality of service idea. So, you know, where are they contributing to delays, loss, etc.? Okay. So last time I mentioned some good books. Kuro's, and I'm going from the bottom up, so physical up. And that's William Stallings does that. A lot of them do that. The other book I recommended, Kuro's and Ross, goes from the top down, so you start looking at the applications and what their requirements are, and then you start seeing how the network can fulfill them. But again, we just want some sort of a basic sense of what the various layers are doing. So, starting at the bottom layer, and the physical layer has the responsibility of sending bits over some communication channel. Okay. So the issues all have to do with, you know, again, how can you send those bits, the physical equipment, the characteristics of the media. And there's a lot of different types of media, wire, cable, fiber, radio, satellite, which special sort of radio. Okay. All of the media are going to have characteristics in terms of how much data can you transmit, so what's the speed at which you can transmit the data, and what's the likelihood of error. So if you're using a radio system, you're more likely to have errors than if you're on fiber. Fiber has very good error characteristics. Okay. And there's always a limit to how much you can send, how much data you can send. Okay. So even if your medium is perfect, no noise, there's a limit, a cap to how much you can send. And in the presence of blackjack, in the presence of noise, blackjack in theory. I take that back. In theory, there's no cap to what you can send, but in the presence of noise and flaws in the mediums, yeah, we'll see that there is. Okay. So that, again, feeds into the transmission rates that you can reliably achieve. And the other issue is that absolutely no medium gives completely error-free transmission. Some are better than others. Okay, so I've sort of thrown this in more for completeness than anything else, but we can say a few things about any sort of signal, then we can sort of look at bits. And so Fourier theory says that all signals are composed of potentially an infinite number of sinusoids. So you can send anything as a sequence, as a combination of a weighted combination of sinusoids. Okay. And so those sinusoids will have different frequencies, and the bandwidth of the signal refers to what frequencies are used to represent the signal. Okay. So one of the first things you might think of for representing a bit is just send a pulse. So on, off, or positive, negative. And one interesting thing about pulses is that they require an infinite bandwidth to actually recreate. Okay. Having said that, you can approximate them with a finite number of frequencies. Okay. So, on the one hand, you have your signal, which is composed of different frequencies in a certain range, or possibly infinite range. Our channels then also have constraints on what frequencies can be transmitted over the particular channel. Okay. So the bandwidth of the channel then refers to the maximum frequency that it can be sent over that channel. Okay. That's not a sharp cutoff, but typically we'll use bandwidth to refer to the frequency at which half the power gets through, so it'll tail off after that. Okay, so all channels, you're going to have to match up your signal and your signal bandwidth and channel bandwidth. Okay. Now, again, if in an ideal world, that's all you would have to do, but all channels are going to be subject to noise and interference as well. Okay, so that's going to alter the shape of your signal from sender to receiver. Okay. There's a number of different sources for that noise. Okay, so you have thermal noise or white noise, and that's or background noise, and that's sort of constant and always present. And so this is the thermal noise is usually the one we use to look at what are the actual bounds on how much data we can send. Okay. In addition to this sort of environmental noise, we can have other noises with other characteristics. So impulse noise also comes from the environment, but it is short, sharp distortions. Okay, so sort of one-off type distortions. Okay, so the problem is that that's going to obliterate a signal for the duration of that of the impulse. Okay, and then multiple signals also can interfere with each other. So if you're sending on adjacent channels, then signals can interfere with each other. Okay. Okay, so as a theoretical proposition, this white noise is going to put a cap on how much data we can transmit. Okay. And that cap is given by the Shannon capacity theorem. And so the cap depends on the bandwidth of the channel and then what's called the signal-to-noise ratio, and where the signal-to-noise ratio is the average signal power over the average noise power. Okay. And so the main thing to notice, which is probably fairly intuitive, is that the better your ratio, the more signal power you have to noise power, the bigger your capacity. Okay. So that provides the theoretical cap on how much information we can send. In practice, you're not necessarily going to push up against that. So there are additional issues with the transmission of the signal, which has to do with sort of what happens to it as it travels. And the first thing that happens as a signal travels is that the power decreases. Okay. This is a big factor in radio systems. No matter what medium you're using, the signal does, the power decreases as it travels. Okay. So the main practical implication of that is that, you know, again, you can't send your signal over an arbitrarily long distance. You need to, at some point, stop and repeat your signal, either by just receiving it as is and boosting the power, or reconstituting it. Okay. Depending on the characteristics of the channel, not all of the frequencies of the signal attenuate at the same rate. Okay. And again, this is particularly an issue in wireless systems, but it happens in whatever system you're choosing. Okay. So if not all of the components that make up the signal are changing the same, the shape of the signal changes. It becomes distorted. Okay. And again, you need to potentially need to compensate for that in terms of digital signaling, the packet forwarding methods they have, store and forward. You just convert the signals to bits and forward it by converting the bits to signals, so the whole signal is just recreated. Okay, and finally, and again, this is in shared media like radio, you can get delay distortion. So, you can get delay distortion in anything. Delay distortion means that the different frequency components will propagate at slightly different speeds. And so again, that's going to distort the shape of your signal. Okay. Additionally, again, if you have sufficient delay, then you might get signals overlapping with each other, and you know, those sorts of issues have to be dealt with. Okay, so that's all of that sort of refers to generic signals. Again, we're dealing with a specific type of signal, a bit, and so there's a couple of ways you can produce those bits. Okay, and so in the one case, essentially you send a pulse, and in the second case you send a sinusoid, so a frequency, it's a specific frequency, and then you in some way modify that frequency. Okay. So, what we said about pulses is that they're represented by some number of frequencies, and the frequency, you know, again, you're running, your bandwidth runs from zero then to whatever the highest frequency you choose to represent, or you choose to keep within your pulse. So, you would filter your signal and the low pass filter and send that along. And so within that, there are a number of different options for how you encode the bits, even with pulses. And generally what they do, they either depend on the amplitude of the pulse or the value of the pulse at any given time, or they depend on the change in value. Okay. And the reason you want to possibly change values is that, you know, it's not good to get runs of either zeros or ones. They can cause problems. Okay. With sinusoidal representations, you're now dealing with a band around a specific frequency, a carrier frequency. Okay. Okay. So the question then becomes about how what sort of bit rates can we achieve? And in general, we assume that, at a basic level, we have to send at least 2 bits, but it's possible that we can send 2 to the amp, or we can send more than 2 bits. Yeah, I'm not saying that well. We either, at a basic, actually, we can send 1 bit, either 0 or 1, but for any signaling element, we could send more than 1 bit, so we could send 2 bits. There would be 4 combinations of that. You can send 3 bits. There are 8 combinations of that, etc. Okay. And if we're sending pulses, then well, we're going to have different levels, different voltage levels for each of our different combinations. Okay. So, if we want to send, again, m bits, then we're going to have 2 to the m levels. If you want to send 2 bits, you have 4 levels. Okay. So, again, as a theoretical maximum over a noiseless channel, we can relate the bit rate to the channel bandwidth and the number of levels that we're using. Okay, so we have, again, an overall cap of channel capacity. If we go back to this, what we can say is, well, actually, we can send whatever just as long as we keep increasing the levels, but again, we're going to butt up against the fact that we do have noise, and the fact that in the presence of noise, it's going to be difficult to distinguish. You know, the more levels you have, the more difficult it is to distinguish between one level and the next. Okay. So, sort of just as an example, we have a channel with a 1 megahertz bandwidth. We have a signal to noise ratio for that channel, and which is handily picked to give us easy numbers. But and so the question is, what would an appropriate bit rate be, and what would an appropriate signaling level be? So your signal-to-noise ratio gives you your channel capacity. But again, you know, we know that it's really hard to actually get up to the maximum capacity, so we pick some rate under that figure. Okay, so in theory, we can get 6 megabits per second. So in practice, we'll say we get 4 megabits per second. And so then the question becomes, how many levels do we need to send in order to achieve that? And so we go to our bit rate formula, so 4 megabits per second. It's 2 times W times log L. And if their numbers nicely, so log L is 2, or L is 4, so you make 4 levels, 2 bits per signaling element.
Can you redefine the signaling level? What is it, like the amplitude of it, or like the bit rate of the signaling level?
The level is it's really the number of different signals you have to send.
Like in groups, like bit 0, 1, and 1.
Yeah. Okay, so say you're sending 2 bits. Again, there are 4 combinations, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Okay, so we're sending, you're trying to represent this as a pulse. That means we have to have 4 different pulses, which means 4 different voltages. So the level is just the number of different elements you need. Okay. So that's sort of just, again, some rules of thumb, how you would think about, sending bits. There's a number of different schemes, specifically, we're looking at sending a single bit here. And again, they split into schemes that rely on the level to denote your signaling element, and then schemes that rely on transitions. Okay. And so what can you do if you're just looking at levels? Well, the most obvious thing is that you just, 1 is a pulse, 0 is the absence of a pulse. You can improve this slightly by making 1 a positive pulse and 2 a negative pulse. And that has a smaller power requirement, because for the same difference in voltage, you're sending it half the amplitude. Okay. Okay, and for bipolar, you send 1s at plus and minus, and zeros at 0, so you get power requirement again, and you get a slightly more desirable frequency spectrum. Okay, so that's fine. The main problem, again, with these schemes is that if you have long strings of particular zeros, but zeros are 1 depending on your encoding, then you can lose track of exactly what bit you're looking at. It's hard to clock if things aren't changing. Okay. If you're using sort of plus minus to represent your voltages, then if you get polarity issues, also you completely flip all the bits. Okay. So to avoid schemes where you get these sort of long periods where nothing is happening, you require that the bits be represented by transitions, not just the pulse value, but the change in the value. Okay. And so
non-return to zero inverted as a one denoted by a transition and a zero denoted by no transition.
Has an improved frequency characteristic. You still have, for this one, you still do have an issue of long runs of zeros. To avoid that, you can use something like Manchester encoding, where ones and zeros are both represented by a transmission, sorry, a transition. There's a number of options for that. Okay, so, yeah. In Manchester encoding, you always have a transition in the middle of the bit, and for differential, you have transitions in both the middles and possibly the starts. Okay, so again, I don't think I'll belabor the point of sort of the transitions for each of these, but you know, one thing you can notice is, again, for the Manchester encodings, you are getting, the bits are changing, so that you are getting, you aren't getting this phenomenon where you're losing your timing. Okay. So that's sort of one set of schemes, and those would be used sort of exclusively on wired media. The other possibility for sending bits is to look at sinusoids, so pick a frequency, and then in some way modify that sinusoid. Okay, so changes in the values of some component of the sinusoid are used to indicate different bits. Okay. So, what does a sinusoid consist of? Well, there's three components that define it. You have the frequency, so what's the periodicity? You have the amplitude, what's the power size, and then you have the phase, so shifting it back and forth relative to the axis, relative to the x-axis. Okay. So again, you can change any one of these components to represent bits. Okay. Amplitude shift keying is not that common, because, you know, again, it's not very power efficient, so you have to have your basic one at a level to be received and then go up from there, so it's not terribly power efficient. Okay. Frequency shift keying and phase shift keying are both used. And again, depending on how clever you are, it's easier or harder to actually represent the bits. So just as we discussed before with levels, you can introduce a number of modifications to represent multiple bits at the same time. So the signaling rate is the rate at which the signaling element changes. And for each signaling element, you might have one bit, two bits, three bits. And so that means that your bit rate can be different. Okay, so if you're sending 3 bits per signal, per signaling element, then your bit rate is 3 times your signaling rate or your baud rate. Okay, so again, you can, all of these are used. You can either change the phase or you can change the frequency. Again, when you're changing phase, it's easier to change the phase a smaller amount rather than a larger amount. So it's easier to change it by plus minus 90 degrees than by 180 degrees. And so, again, phase shift keying is 180 degrees, so it's conceptually easy. You're just going plus minus, essentially, again, but it's hard to demodulate. Differential phase shift keying is you, again, use, you reference the previous bit, so you change relative to your previous bit. So, again, phase shift keying, you see the plus minus, and with differential phase shift keying, they're shifting back and forth by the plus or minus 90, depending on whether you have a 0 or a 1. Okay. So, again, you can, there's no problem in adding in multiple bits per signaling element, but again, you'll have to have more changes available. Okay. So, not sure if that's, I'm not sure that quadrant is that common these days, but you know, you can either again change within the one aspect, or you can combine multiple aspects so you can change, say, amplitude and phase at the same time. Okay. So the more bits per signaling element, the higher the throughput, but the more complicated it gets to do it. So, again, this is a quadrature amplitude modulation example. So we're changing both the amplitude and the phase. And so, again, you just need 4 different combinations to denote the 4 combinations of bits. Again, that's not going to be the most efficient scheme in the world. And so you can change phase. You can also change frequency. And so obviously you need different, however many different frequencies as you have levels or you have combinations of bits. So if you have just 1 bit, so 0 or 1, you need 2 different frequencies, and typically you express that as an offset of a carrier frequency. No problem having more frequencies and more levels. And here you have 4 different frequencies, so you can represent 4 different combinations, of which is 2 bits. So, depending on
how much energy you put into bits, and depending on the modulation scheme you use, then you're going to get different characteristics in terms of what bit rate you can send at, and also in terms of the bit error rate. Okay. So typically, yeah, before we were talking about the signal to noise ratio, but the signal we're sending again is a specific type of signal, a bit, and so EB over N0 is sort of the signal-to-noise ratio normalized to, or specific to bits. Okay. And we see that, again, it's related to two components, signal-to-noise ratio, and then the bandwidth efficiency, so it's divided by the bandwidth efficiency. Okay. Now, further, our bandwidth efficiency is going to be affected by, our bandwidth efficiency is affected by the modulation scheme we use, and the bit error rate then is tied to the signal-to-noise ratio and the bandwidth efficiency. Bit error rate is tied to the EB over N0, I should say, and that's further tied to the signal-to-noise ratio and the bandwidth efficiency. Okay, so that means that your bit error rate is dependent on the modulation scheme you use and how much power you're willing to put into the signal. Okay, so we can also relate EB over N0 to our spectral efficiency, which refers to the theoretical capacity of the channel relative to the bandwidth. And so, again, you can use that to decide what sort of minimum EB over N0 we need to achieve a given spectral efficiency. Okay, so, again, our modulation techniques are feeding into our bandwidth efficiency. Our bandwidth efficiency is feeding into our EB N0 versus signal-to-noise ratio, and the EB over N0 also feeds into the bit error rate. Okay, so this is, again, just for noting. But the bottom line is we have our bit error rates are related to EB over N0. And if you work back to the signal-to-noise ratio, okay, the bit error rates differ for your different modulation schemes. And within the modulation schemes, they also differ according to the levels you have. Okay. So, that gives us, again, the sort of a likelihood of bits being an error, so there's the signal-to-noise ratio feeds into that, the modulation scheme feeds into that. Typically, when we're looking at these things, then we're probably not looking at a single bit. We're looking at some sort of
block of bits being sent, either a packet or a frame. Should probably use the word frame here. And so what we can note is that the probability of an error within a frame or within a block of bits is, well, 1 minus the probability there is no error. Here we've assumed that everything's independent, so each bit either has an error or doesn't, just independent of other bits. And arguably, that's not a great assumption, but you know, again, we're just getting a feel here. So if you expand out this polynomial, you end up with 1 minus NP plus some function of p squared. If p is small, then that's approximately NP, so your
bit of your packet error rate is related to essentially the length of the packets, either, well, the packet error rate or the block error rate is related to the length of the block you send.
Okay, so what's the takeaway from all this? Well, I guess the takeaway is that depending on how you set up your modulation schemes, you have different error characteristics and different transmission speeds possible. And also that no matter what you do, you can't guarantee that everything is going to arrive correctly. Okay. And so that brings us to our next layer. The data link layer. Okay. So what the physical layer is providing us is a bit pipe. So you can send streams of bits, but so you can make some assumptions. So you can assume that the bits arrive in the same order that they were sent. So that's one thing we don't have to worry about. But we can't assume that they all arrive correctly. Okay. And so what the data link layer has to do is figure out when bits have not arrived correctly, and if they don't arrive correctly, do something about it. Okay. So the transmission delay and the propagation delay, so the time it takes to form bits and the time it takes to move those bits down the bit pipe, are going to impact on the efficiency of the schemes that you can use to deal with these problems. Okay. So basically, in order to deal with these issues, we're going to have to, again, figure out if there's an error and do something about an error if there is an error. And in order to examine correctness, we're not going to look at the bit stream, but we're going to divide the stream into chunks. And we're going to send a chunk at a time, or a chunk at a time, or a
comes with the gold, will be framed, so we're going to have to
sort of define what we mean by these chunks, and then we examine the chunks for error and have some protocols for dealing then with the error. Okay. So the main issues that arise in doing this are, how do we assemble our frames and manage our frames? How do we then examine our frames to see if they arrived correctly or not? And if they didn't, what do we do about it? And the answer about what do we do about it is that we have some way of requesting retransmission of frames sent in error. And so if you can do all of that, if you can sort of package things up into chunks and examine them for errors and fix your errors, that's, you know, the main goal of the data link layer. Sorted, we'll have a quick look at some of the features of a data link layer protocol. We'll use HDLC because most things, it's ancient at this point, but most subsequent protocols are based on it, so we might as well. And the main thing you'll notice is, well, it makes use of all these theoretical options, but, you know, again, there's a lot of certain management that has to go on as well, which is not terribly theoretically exciting, but does have to happen. Okay, so again, in terms of our theory and our layered architecture, our information is coming down to us from the network layer, probably, and we want to transmit frames across. The only way we can actually do this is to transmit a sequence of bits across. So all the physical layer is doing is just sending these bits. The data link layer has to make the interpretation that, you know, this chunk of the bits is a coherent frame or package, and I have to process that coherent frame or package. Okay. So, again, at the physical layer, we have a problem in that we have no guarantee that the bits are going to arrive correctly. Our noise element is going to obliterate bits with a certain probability, typically singly. And other factors, interference, burst errors, potentially are going to obliterate sequences of bits. Okay. So we can't just take the stream as is. We have to, in some way, examine the data that's coming to us and decide that it's either correct or incorrect. So, the way we do that is we divide the data into chunks,
And then again, then we add sufficient information around that data so that we can recognize the chunk of data as the chunk of data we need to examine and, you know, make some examination of that data. Okay. So we take the data and we package it into frames. Okay. And so what a frame is if you're just sending streams of data, how do you decide where one chunk begins and the next chunk, or one chunk ends and the next chunk begins? You could send a gap between frames, but you know, again, depending on the vagaries of transmission, these gaps might become shorter or longer, and it's hard to end you up and you have an inefficiency in having to leave the gaps to begin with. You could do some sort of counting systems or, you know, character count, how many pieces of data are in any given frame. The problem with that is that if you have an error then in your character count, you lose your frame sequences. Okay, so here in our example, frame one is 5 characters, so you need to know where frame 2 starts and that the first piece of information is the size of the frame. So frame 2 is 5 characters. For frame 3, the first piece of information is the size of the frame. It's 8 characters, etc. Now, if we have a bit error, which changes the character count, we've now incorrectly framed, in this case, frame 2, and every subsequent frame is going to be incorrect as well. Okay. So what we need to do is have some explicit indication of start and end. And we want that to be independent of the frames, independent of the data. Okay. So what we do is we add what's called a flag, which is a special set of characters, and we add it at the start and end of each chunk of data to, again, indicate the beginning and end of the frame. Okay. So a typical flag is 0 followed by 6 ones followed by 0. Now, one issue with having a flag like that is that there's absolutely no reason that that pattern cannot occur in the data itself. Okay. So what you have to do is make sure that that pattern does not occur within the data. And so the easiest way of doing that is anytime you have 5 ones, you put in one extra bit, you put in a 0 as an extra bit. And you do that regardless of what the next bit would be. So in this case, you actually don't have any flags in here, but you perform the stuffing anyway, because that's the easiest thing to do. It's the easiest algorithm. It's just always, every time you find 5 ones, chuck in a 0. Okay. And so then when you receive your bit, every time you find 5 ones, you know you're going to find a 0 after that, just pull it out. Okay. So it's an easy algorithm, easy to implement.
easy to implement and means that flag will only appear at the beginning and end of a frame.
Okay, so again, just you don't worry about whether you actually have flags in the middle. You just always, after every five, you know, you see five ones in the data, just make put a zero in that ensures that it's not going to look like a frame. Okay, and so that's yeah, the basic idea. In practice, you can use a combination of methods. So you can use the flags plus a character count, and that will allow you to at least know when you should find the flag at the end of the frame, and it gives you an additional way of checking for errors. Okay. Okay. So that means that we now have a way of sending chunks of data that the receiver will recognize as chunks of data. Okay, so now that we've sent the chunks of data, we can ask, well, what can you do about transmission errors? We now know what we need to examine. And so if you receive just the data, we have absolutely no way of knowing whether it's correct or not. So you need to send some additional information, which gives you a clue as to whether the data is correct or not. And so this is adding redundancy to your data. Okay. So we have data. We put it through some sort of generator. You generate the extra bits, and you send along not just your original data, but the extra bits. The goal, then, is to use those extra bits to decide whether your data as a whole is correct or incorrect. So you have this information, and there's a couple things you can do. You could try to use the information not only to detect an error, but also to correct the error. That tends to be harder to do and typically is not done. You can use feedback error control, and here you just use your information to detect the error, and then correction is a matter of sending the data again. Okay, and that's a much more common thing to have happen. Okay, so again, what form can these checks take? And we'll look at two options, parity checks and cyclic redundancy codes. The conceptually easiest thing you can do is a parity check. Okay. And what a parity check is, it's a check on the number of bits, the number of either ones or zeros. Okay. So as a policy, we can add one bit, and we add that bit so that our entire collection of bits has an even number of ones. Okay, so if there was an odd number of ones in the data, you would add a one. If there was already an even number of ones in the data, you would add a zero. So, how is this helpful? Well, if you flip a single bit, then your even number of ones is going to change to an odd number of ones, either because you have an extra one or one less one. Okay. If the one changes to zero, you have one less one. If the zero changes to one, you have one more one, but that changes odd, even to odd. Okay, so you can detect any single bit error. You can't detect even numbers of errors. So if you change two bits, your number of ones is still even. If you change four bits, your number of ones is still even. Okay, so using that, you can't fix anything, and it's actually not really great for detection, but it's easy to think about, so it's easy to get the concept. Okay, so this is basically what all your options are. Okay, so in our first example, if everything arrives okay, that's fine. If you have one bit error, you prepare and you check the text, that's fine. So you check the packet, but at least you have found the error. If you have two bit errors, again, you still have an even number of ones, so you haven't detected the error and you're now accepting data that's actually an error. That works for any even numbers. Okay. Okay. So we can push the parity check idea a little bit, and so we can use it to possibly detect incorrect errors, but again, not in any sort of terribly reliable way. Okay. So the way a two-dimensional parity check works is you arrange your data in a series of rows or columns, and then you do a parity check on the rows and columns of the data. So we can detect an error as long as there's an odd number of errors in either a row or a column, and we can correct any single bit error with that. The problem is if we have an even number of errors in both rows and columns, then again, we're going to miss the problem altogether. Okay, so just again, looking at a few quick examples. If we have a single error, we can detect it. And because now we know we can identify both the row and column of the error, so we could actually correct that. If we have two errors in the same row, we can detect it because it'll show up in the columns, but we can't correct it because we don't actually know what row the error occurred in. So you have the parity bits show up in the columns as being problematic, but not in the rows. Okay. So, even for here, we can detect the error because we have odd numbers in both rows and columns, but we then can't correct it if these two bits were in error, you'd get exactly the same parity check. Okay, so there is a bit of theory and definition around these sorts of parity checks. And so basically, you can measure what can be corrected and what can be detected by knowing how much you have to change to get from one valid combination to the next valid combination. Okay. So the Hamming distance between any two code words, so the combination of bits plus redundancy, is the number of bits that have to change in order to get from one code word to the second one. And so here we change 3 bits to get from one word to the other, so the distance is 3. And so for any scheme, you're going to have a minimum Hamming distance. Okay. So for our simplest scheme, our single parity, you always have to change 2 bits to get from one valid code word to another valid code word. So the Hamming distance for that scheme is 2. Okay. And so as a theory, if you look at this minimum Hamming distance for a scheme, then we can detect less than or equal to that distance minus 1. So again, for our single parity bit, the Hamming distance is 2. You can detect any one bit error. You can correct any combination of strictly less than d over 2 bit errors. Okay, so if d is 2, then d over 2 is 1. You can correct less than 1 bit error, so you can't correct anything, which is what we saw intuitively. Similarly, for our block parity checks, we saw we had to change 4 things to get from one valid possibility to the next. So D is 4. You can detect any 3 errors, and you can correct strictly less than 2 errors, so you can correct any single error. Okay.
So all of this theoretical part, is it important from examination point of view, the written examination?
I will be asking, yes, one question from all of the network stuff, and I'll give some problems to give you some. I will post some problem sets, so that'll give you some indication of the types of things I could ask about, but yes, I will be actually examining this.
And rest of it will be like numerical simulation.
Yeah, the rest of it is again queuing, some various analysis techniques. Yeah. Okay, so the sense we get from the previous discussion is that again, parity checks are not terribly useful. Particularly if you they're useful if you think that all you're getting is single bit errors. If you
but you know, we already said we have these sort of burst errors and other sorts of errors, so those won't be dealt with by parity checks. Okay, so the most commonly used error detection, not as an alternative even, but just that used, is the cyclic redundancy check. Okay. The cyclic redundancy check is based on polynomial theory. We don't need to know it, but basically it uses the polynomials to generate our redundancy bits and does it in such a way, again, it's unlikely that different polynomials essentially have the same factors, so we can use that fact to generate our redundancy. Okay, so we're not going to worry about the theory, but just how does it work? Well, you have k bits, and then we want to produce n bits of redundancy. To do that, we need a generator function of size n plus 1. And we divide. And so what we want to do is to produce a code word which is essentially represents a polynomial divisible by our generator function. Okay, and so we do that by dividing our bits plus n zeros appended by the generator function. And so here we have 8 bits, and 5-bit generator function. So we're trying to generate 4 extra redundancy bits. And so we take our data, 4 bits appended on. That's essentially, if you think of polynomials, you're raising factors of the polynomial by 4, and we divide by our generator function. That's going to give us a remainder, and the remainder is our redundancy. Why? Because if you append the remainder then to your bits, then you're actually divisible by the generator function. Okay. So if the mathematics we're using is, again, exclusive ORs, so we start out and we can exclusive OR the first 5 digits with our generator function, and that gives us 1011. And that's smaller than our generator function, so we have to drop down another digit, and we can then apply the generator function, and again, you keep going, and you get your remainder, 0110. Okay, so again, it's that remainder you will then append on to your original data. And again, if you went and checked, you'd see that with the remainder appended on, then the thing is divisible by your generator function. Okay. And so when you receive the data at the other end, you do that division and you see whether you should not get a remainder. It should be a remainder of 0. If you do get a remainder,
there was an error. Okay. And so, let me see what we didn't do is one. Okay. Yeah, so just trying to figure out where the error was. So in this case, actually, our redundancy is received an error. And again, we see if we do the division out that you have a remainder, and therefore you know that something was wrong. Okay, and so again, the only way that the error will not be detected is if you've gone from one polynomial divisible by this generator function to a different polynomial divisible by the generator function, and we can choose our generators so that this is not likely to happen. Okay. So there will be standard CRC generators available, and you just use one of them. Okay, so that's an hour and a half-ish, probably less since we had a little talk before starting. We'll take a little break now. I've got to take a break, and we'll come back and finish off with the what do we do about errors now that we can detect them? How do we deal with them? Okay.